This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Teacher strikes sweep the nation. Hi, I'm Jennifer Kashinka, in for Gordon Deal. Some of our top stories and headlines on This Weekend. Teacher strikes are moving across the country. We'll take a look at why this is happening and what the outcome may be. A survey on how we're budgeting, saving, and using our banks, because it's April, Financial Literacy Month. Why many of us are lying to Facebook about our birth dates, names, and occupations, and the foods that could help battle or even prevent depression.
We often don't think of depression, which a disease, as having an actual organ attached to it, the brain. You know, this is a disease of the brain. People think of the mind or emotion, something that really isn't a physical thing. But they're looking at the brain, and this brain needs nutrients.
Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal will be here in about 10 minutes with some interesting new research on the connection between food and depression. Well, after big cuts to education, teachers in a number of states, including Oklahoma and Kentucky, are taking an activist stance, and some GOP legislatures are listening to their demands. Michelle Hackman of the Wall Street Journal is following this nationwide movement and joins us now. Michelle, did this all start in West Virginia a few weeks back, or did it begin before that?
It really did all start with West Virginia. We saw there a group of teachers really rise up through social media and otherwise and tell even their union that they wanted to strike. So typically we think of, you know, unions as sort of instigating these sorts of movements. But really what we saw in this situation was a group of people rising up and saying, we've had enough of this low pay. We want to take action, and sort of the union following them.
It was kind of an ugly week or so, but the teachers ended up getting pretty much what they wanted, did they not?
That's right. So they requested a 5% pay raise. The legislature initially passed a 4% pay raise, and the union actually said, you know, why don't you take that? That's as good as we'll get. And the teachers were like, no. You know, we are going to continue fighting until we get what we want. And lo and behold, they did. And that is really, I think, across the country, we saw people seeing how successful they were, and that's really what sparked these other teachers to take similar action.
We're speaking with Michelle Hackman of the Wall Street Journal. Michelle, is it always about salary, or are there other issues here in play?
There are other issues. We've seen since the recession in 2008, education funding sort of cut across the board. It really, in most states, hasn't recovered to those pre-recession levels. And particularly in Oklahoma, where I spent the week last week, the state's seen some of the most severe budget cuts. Adjusted for inflation, the education budget overall has fallen by 28%. And so that means teacher salaries. It also means classroom sizes, classroom supplies. You know, a lot of teachers I spoke to said, my kids don't even have enough textbooks for each of them to be able to take one home.
Michelle, what is the risk of a strike?
Well, the risk is definitely that teachers, you know, are risking overplaying their hand. Teachers in general are a very trustworthy group of people. People tend to think highly of them. But unions, especially in red states like Oklahoma and West Virginia, a couple other places where they're considering striking, like Arizona, Kentucky, unions are not particularly popular entities, and so they're risking sort of bringing about some kind of backlash by taking too much of an activist stance.
Up to this point, what has been the reaction of the general public in these states?
So in Oklahoma, where I spent a few days last week, you know, very conservative state, I actually didn't see a lot of backlash. I saw people being very supportive. You know, people were sharing Facebook posts of teachers that were posting their pay stubs. We saw, you know, I turned on the radio and I heard DJs on the radio saying, oh, we're going to walk out too. You know, there were a lot of public employees saying that they were going to protest along with teachers. So far it's being received very positively there.
So it's not a general feeling of anti-union in these places.
That's right. And some people, Jennifer, think that partially the reason that's happening is that, you know, first of all, a lot of these teachers like other people in America, like other people especially opposed to President Donald Trump, have become newly activated, newly politically active after the 2016 election. So I think there's some of that. I think there definitely is also some of, you know, the Republican Party under President Trump doesn't have as much reason to be opposed to unions as it used to. You know, unions make up a lot of the people that support the president, so we're seeing them take on some of these more union-friendly or working-class-friendly messages.
I was going to ask, Michelle, has there been any reaction to the strikes by local Congress people representing those states and those districts?
You know, not really that I've seen. I think what's really noteworthy here is the way that the state legislators are reacting. You know, typically in a strike, they'd be very antagonistic, but we've seen in West Virginia and Oklahoma just the threat of a strike, especially in Oklahoma, has really spurred these people to action, to pass pay raises, to pass tax increases, which really would have been thought anathema just, you know, a couple months or years ago.
Thanks, Michelle. Michelle Hackman of The Wall Street Journal. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. More evidence that you are what you eat. Elizabeth Bernstein of The Wall Street Journal is here to tell us more about food that could help battle depression. Elizabeth, what did researchers look at?
Researchers have been looking for about a decade now into diet and how it helps with depression. And we often don't think of depression, which a disease, as having an actual organ attached to it, the brain. You know, this is a disease of the brain. People think of the mind or emotion, something that really isn't a physical thing. But they're looking at the brain, and this brain needs nutrients, same as your heart needs a good diet. And so that's what they're looking at. And they're finding that depression can really be hurt by a bad diet and helped by a good diet.
When you talk about a bad diet and a good diet, what specifically are you talking about?
So we talk about a bad diet. We're talking about, sadly, a typical Western diet, a lot of processed food, a lot of fats, fried foods, fast foods. All of that essentially harms your brain. It sort of clogs it up, but it doesn't have very many nutrients at all. But those trans fats they promote inflammation, and inflammation is one of the causes of depression. So it's very, very bad for you, a bad diet.
How about the healthy diet? What do we consider a healthy diet?
A healthy diet, what they've done a lot of research on which types of diet would be best. It's pointing to a Mediterranean diet. It may just be, you know, that they're studying that diet a lot. But a Mediterranean diet is what we sort of know to be fruits, very heavy fruits and vegetables, extra virgin olive oil, yogurts, cheeses, legumes, nuts, a lot of seafood, whole grains. And you can have meat, small portions of red meat. But it's this diet that has a lot of omega-3 fats in it. It's got a lot of healthy fat in it. Whole grains, that's what they're looking at. And they're finding that it not only can prevent depression, but it can treat a depression once it's shown up. So it's a very, very powerful thing.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, your story chronicled some people who actually changed their diet and saw some benefits. Talk about those people.
Depression is a very tough thing to treat. It's got many different causes. Doctors don't really know, you know, all of them and why one person, what might be causing theirs. And so they tend to, you know, try everything they have. People go to years of therapy. People try many different antidepressants. So they're really trying when things don't work to put the next thing at it, throw something at it, and see if it works. And so I talk to people who've gone through this cycle. It's very debilitating, and it sort of adds to your depression. You know, you have a disease. You're not getting a handle on it. You're not finding the effective treatment, so that makes you feel even worse. So I talked to people who said that they sort of gave up on the antidepressants. They said, you know, I'm not going to try this anymore. I'm going to go back. I'm going to research, you know, something else, maybe something a little more alternative or organic. And they came to finding out about food. There is a lot of information out there about how food is helpful. Found out about food, changed their diets, and had really powerful effects. I mean, I talked to one woman in the story who had depression for 30 years on and off, and finally said, you know, let me see what food will do, and within months felt better. It was gone. So she ate this Mediterranean diet. She found out cashews were helpful, and she's just been doing it that way, and it went away. That depression went away.
Is it possible that once you start eating better, you become healthier, you feel better, and then you start making better decisions for yourself and becoming a little bit more disciplined about your life, which would also stave off some depression.
Sure, that is, you know, absolutely what happened. I mean, this woman even said, oh, you know, I lost 15 pounds, and then you feel better too. But for a real depression that's in your brain, just, you know, losing some weight or, you know, isn't going to really do it. This is, you know, so it's probably got many different mechanisms that it's working on. Yes, you do feel better. Maybe you're going to exercise more. If you start to feel better, you have more energy because you're eating better food to give you energy. Exercise also is a very, very powerful antidote to depression. You do. That's very helpful. Maybe you're going out more. You're seeing your friends more. So then that, again, is very helpful for depression, the social support.
And Elizabeth, your story talks about nutritional psychiatry. What is that?
So it's this field that's growing up. It's sort of a baby field inside psychiatry as they see the research on how diets are helping, you know, both prevent and treat depression. And so we're seeing doctors now ask. It's very, very rare that a psychiatrist, you go in, doctor, I'm depressed, and the doctor's going to say, well, what are you eating? That's very, very rare. But now doctors are starting to pay attention to that. Some doctors who consider themselves nutritional psychiatrists will put nutritionists on board. They'll put chefs on board, meaning they'll put them in their practice, on staff. They'll have chefs that their patients can consult with to, you know, help them create, you know, nice meals for their new diet. They're seeing at the American Psychiatric Association presentations on how food affects your brain. And there's a new research organization internationally on nutritional psychiatry. So there's a field growing up because this is actually, this is serious findings in this research. This isn't, you know, a one-off thing. They're really starting to understand our diet makes our brain sick or makes our brain healthy.
Super, super interesting stuff. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. It's 21 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on this weekend. Sloths are hot. Armadillos are not. Some zoos are struggling to draw a crowd for the animals that are not all that popular. Claire Ensbury of the Wall Street Journal has written about the effort to get some affection for overlooked species. Claire, what are animal ambassadors?
There are a certain animal that represents its species, and often it's a species that needs some protection and where they really want to get out an education effort among to protect that species. So they have an animal that's an ambassador for their whole species. They might have a couple of them, like penguins and a couple of owls and things, but they really represent that species, and they might be an individual animal that is more comfortable with the public, and they bring them out to meet visitors and to talk about, their habitat and conservation efforts, and to get people to like them, basically, and to care about them and to do what they can and whatever way they can to conserve and preserve the planet.
So, Claire, are they kind of doing some PR for the zoos, or are they doing it for the animals, or both?
I said both, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, some zoos have smaller programs. Some zoos have like 60, 70 ambassadors representing 40 species. And, you know, you can book tours with them at an extra price. So it's bringing in revenue. And, you know, some of them with the real hot animals, the real popular animals like the sloths. Sloths, everybody thinks are adorable. Red pandas are really popular. They're encounters with them are often sold out, but then they have the variety. You know, there are apparently in little kids love insect encounters, and they love, you know, seeing all these little creepy crawlers. And they have different ones for the kids area, and the adults often they will have age limitations. Like if you wanted to go on a cheetah walk before the zoo opens, you know, and walk with the trainer and a cheetah, the cheetah's on a leash, and you can take your morning walk with the trainer. So it's definitely helping the zoos, and, you know, they want to have more ambassadors and more things to attract visitors. But it's also helping the species, because a lot of these animals, really nobody, a lot of people aren't familiar with them. And so it's an education process, and, you know, the more you know about a species, the more you might care about it if you meet it one-on-one. You know, one woman said, you know, who would have thought people would bond with a skunk, you know, but people become amazed. So it's really for both.
We're speaking with Clara Ansbury, The Wall Street Journal. Clara, you mentioned the cheetah walk. Now, people are paying extra money to do something like that?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, there are things that are called keeper talks, and those are free for anybody who comes to the zoo and pays the admission. You know, a trainer might come out with an armadillo or a chimp or something and just kind of stand out at certain parts of the day and just talk about this animal. And anybody who's passing by could enjoy that and learn a little bit more. But the encounters, the private sort of small group behind the scenes costs extra money, and people will pay, you know, it could be up to $195, close to $200, in addition to the ticket price to have this half hour or hour time sort of behind the scenes. They like to, you know, people like to see what's going on that other people can. So they can, you know, they get a little bit more information. They can talk one-on-one with the trainer. Sometimes they can feed the animal and just, you know, it's for people who really like a certain species or are enamored with them or really intrigued by them.
I think I'll skip the cheetah walk, but the rest sounds good. Clara Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. FMLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. It's harder than ever for businesses to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations. What's a company to do? Kronos. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they are applied consistently and fairly. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/compliance. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
Gordon Deal with the weekend off. I'm Jennifer Kishinka sitting in. Some of our top stories and headlines on This Weekend, a look at how we're budgeting, saving, and using our banks, why many of us are lying to Facebook about our birth dates, names, and occupations, the case of the missing lunch, and the latest on office refrigerator etiquette, and the scary raccoons that are menacing Ohio. That story in about 20 minutes. You probably check your bank balance every week, but do you have an annual budget? A new survey says probably not. And joining us now to talk about financial literacy is Russell McCarron, financial expert at USAA Bank. Russell, what are some of the findings of your survey when it comes to bank balances?
Well, you hit on a couple of the key takeaways that we saw. So about 77% of Americans are checking their bank balance every week, which is great. But that's not translating into budgeting. So only about a quarter of Americans actually have an annual household budget. So that's one thing at USA we are really encouraging our members and those who aren't our members, make sure you have that budget.
Why is a budget so important?
It's critical for a couple of reasons. One is that it frees you up to be able to spend money on the things that matter to you, creating those, you know, memorable experiences, which two-thirds of Americans told us that they really value. The other thing is it allows people to have a rainy day savings. So if something does come up in the future, you know, an air conditioner comes out or you have to have your car worked on, you've got that money to cover that expense without having to use a credit card or another vehicle.
Now, Russell, I know your survey broke down some generational differences when it comes to checking your bank balance and making budgets. What did you see in differences between millennials versus Generation X versus boomers?
We saw a couple of very interesting things. First of all, about 80% of millennials are checking their balance on a weekly basis, which is higher than other generations. However, fewer of them are creating a budget. Whereas if you were to look at the other end of the spectrum, boomers are, you know, creating a budget. Actually, 92% of them are looking at their credit card or bank statements monthly. And so just very different behavior. So I would really encourage, you know, kind of our younger generations to make sure that you're establishing that budget.
We're speaking with Russell Macaron, financial expert at USAA Bank. What about credit card purchases? Is everybody using credit cards?
So what we're seeing is that credit card is king. So about 80% of Americans regularly use a credit card. But only 36% of those people using credit cards actually understand the benefits and rewards. So that's important because you don't want to be paying hidden fees. You don't want to be paying interest if you can avoid it. And you want to maximize your rewards, you know, earning on things like, you know, dining and gas and groceries, those everyday spending categories.
Russell, why are we not looking at that? I think part of it might be that when you get something in the mail and those brochures, the typeset is about so tiny and it goes on for pages. Are people just not taking the time to look at it?
I think that's a big part of it. I think also, you know, that interest rates have been low for a long time, and so people are less focused on that. But, you know, 50% of the credit cards in the marketplace do have rewards today. So I do think that people are paying attention to that. So you just want to encourage people to make sure that they're taking advantage of that.
What do we understand about our banks and what our banks can do for us?
So whereas most Americans do use a bank, only 36% actually believe that their banks help them save, right? And that's even fewer millennials believe that. So only about 60% of the millennials don't believe that their bank will actually help them save. And so that's one thing at USA we're really pushing. We want all generations to understand that we're here to partner with our members and make sure that we're helping them deliver on their financial goals.
How does a bank help you save?
Well, there's multiple ways. We have a lot of, you know, interaction tools. So even on your mobile device, you can check your accounts. You can move money from a checking into a savings account. You can even go get a savings account, right? And then we give you ways to track progress towards that savings goal.
Certainly banks have changed and evolved like everything else over the years. Do older people have a different kind of relationship with their bank than perhaps the millennials?
I do think that is true. So, you know, what we've seen is older generations do prefer to have that branch to go into potentially or to bank with, whereas millennials are more comfortable doing their banking more online, even on their mobile device. And so that's a big difference. And that's one, you know, opportunity for banks in general is how we make sure that we're reaching people through those devices.
Russell Macaron, financial expert at USAA Bank. It's 21 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Coming up, why we lie to Facebook. Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal on this weekend. Well, it seems that just about every day we're getting bad news from or about Facebook. Fake news, stolen information, Russian trolls, you name it. Maybe that's why so many of us are making stuff up on our profiles. Heidi Vogt of the Wall Street Journal has written a story about why people are lying on Facebook. Heidi, how are people building false identities online?
You know, it's a real mixture. One of the big things people talk about is Facebook, lying about a birth date or a hometown. But there's also a lot of, you know, going on to a merchant like Bed Bath & Beyond or, you know, your grocery store and telling them you're the wrong profession or the wrong zip code or something like that.
Is this a new thing? Are we worried about our identity?
You know, that's a real question. I don't know how new it is. People have really just started to track this over the past few years, and it's been interesting to me how prevalent it is. Some of these research firms say as many as 40-50% of people provide some sort of false information online. So there must be some real concern there.
Your story, Heidi, highlighted one woman who put in her date of birth as 1910, which was just hilarious. Talk about that story.
Oh, yeah. Chris Welland, she's a technology executive, and she's actually worked in this sort of online marketing world before. So she said she's very aware of how this stuff works, and she didn't like the idea of all these different companies being able to track all her stuff together. So she just puts in all kinds of fake information. She said she put in that birthday because she has the experience of knowing that once somebody gets over, say, 90 years old, advertisers don't care about them.
But she did get some ads, didn't she?
Yeah, she ended up, she said, suddenly she started getting lots of ads for slippers.
So only people over 90 wear slippers, right? We're speaking with Heidi Vogt at the Wall Street Journal. Heidi, what about just misspelling your name or giving the wrong phone number? Is that the most common things?
Yeah, those are very big. Also, you know, just providing either a dummy or a fake email address. I think lots of people who don't misrepresent themselves other ways do that. But yeah, I mean, this is also stuff that I do. I always sort of misspell my name or don't give a phone number unless I really have to. There's some sort of extra sense of security in that, you know?
There are also some funny things, though, your story points out where people made up crazy stuff on Facebook and then someone who thought they knew them, a relative or whatever, would take that to be real information, and it causes some awkward moments.
Yeah, it is funny. It makes you realize how much of our interaction happens on Facebook. This one woman used a fake first name, and then she ran into a friend who completely forgot that Pia wasn't her actual name and called her that. There was a guy who got a wedding invitation. His name's Mike Dennison. On Facebook, he's Mike Dennisaurus. The wedding invitation said Mike Dennisaurus on it. So, you know, people really interact with those Facebook personalities and sometimes forget that they're not completely true.
On the other side of things, Facebook is in so much hot water right now. I would think that they don't think some of this is funny.
They have in their terms of service that you have to represent yourself accurately online. They actually block accounts all the time that they see as not being authentic. So it's really something they see as an issue. And also, you know, we all know that one of the reasons Facebook wants all this data is in order to use it for marketing or selling purposes. So that messes up their possibility of doing that if everybody's providing false information.
That's right. I have a friend named Tammy who calls herself Paprika online. Every time I see her, I want to call her Paprika. It's very confusing. Thanks, Heidi. Heidi Vogt of the Wall Street Journal. It's 13 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Coming up, the case of the missing lunch. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Have you ever stolen a coworker's lunch? It's surprisingly common, says CNBC's Kelly Grant. Kelly, what's going on here?
Well, this is something that the internet has been talking about for a couple of days now. There was a Los Angeles-based comedian who took to Twitter last week to recount a play-by-play of an office investigation into a stolen lunch. Not his lunch, but a colleague's. And everyone was fairly riveted by this. And, you know, as we've looked into it, this is, you know, unfortunately not that uncommon of an occurrence. It's almost 1 in 5 workers have, in an American Express survey from last year, copped to eating somebody else's lunch out of the office fridge.
All right. I think that's a little bit weird. Are they doing this on purpose?
It is a little bit, well, just more than a little bit weird, I think, honestly.
Okay.
You know, and some of this, you know, we've talked to a lot of different HR folks who say, yes, you know, this is a pretty constant theme. And, you know, in some cases they do hear that this is, you know, it's purposeful. It's just somebody who, like, for whatever reason, they get a kick out of it. But it can also be cases where this is accidental. You know, you remembered leaving a yogurt in there and you grabbed the wrong one, or, you know, you thought you were clearing out your lunch you had forgotten from last week, and it turns out it was somebody else's, that sort of thing.
Now, Kelly, if someone took your lunch, what is the best approach? What should you do about this?
Hold down your anger. You know, and I'll be honest, this is something that's happened to me too. I have been a victim of this. But you know, generally, you know, when you talk to folks about, like, well, what do you do about this? It's like, you know, you want to be thinking about what steps could you take to better protect yourself. That might be, you know, better labeling your food if you do think this was potentially an accident. But we also hear that's not going to thwart somebody who's pretty determined. Some of the more creative solutions were things like getting a lunchbox that locks, or even there was one woman who reportedly had put her lunch in a brown bag and labeled it breast milk and never had a problem with anyone touching her lunch again.
We're speaking with CNBC's Kelly Grant. Is this a real problem in an office where somebody actually is taking other people's lunches and they know it's one person? Did you find any anecdotal evidence like that?
Well, one of the women I spoke to for this piece, she runs the Ask a Manager blog, and she's got some really wild stories on her website that I would recommend people check out. But she's heard from cases where, you know, they definitely know who the perpetrator is, and in some cases it's even the boss. And that, of course, opens up this whole other layer of, like, well, what do you do when, like, the person you would complain to is the person who's doing it?
And the one last thing about the office food is the stuff that sits there forever, and you get the notice to please clean this out every so often.
Yep, and that's, a lot of offices now, you know, they automatically clear it out. We've got a warning note on our fridge. It's, you know, if it's still there as of this date, it's gone. So, you know, you do have to be aware of any policies or changes within the office on that as well.
I still will go back to my original thought that if 20% of people are eating someone else's lunch, I would think that at least half of that is a mistake.
I would hope so, but it's a lot nicer to think of your coworkers, you know, maybe trying to keep the fridge clean and accidentally throwing this out than purposely going and saying, I'm going to eat her lunch.
CNBC's Kelly Grant, and her report was brought to you by Michigan. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. In Youngstown, Ohio, raccoons' tiny, nimble, human-like hands are only the second scariest thing about them. The first, an outbreak of what residents have described as zombie-like behavior involving raccoons who bare their teeth, walk on their hind legs, and don't seem to be afraid of humans. According to local media reports, police have taken more than a dozen calls about these incidents since the start of March. One resident says he spotted one while he was walking his dogs. The raccoon stood up on its hind legs, showed its teeth, and then fell over backwards and went into an almost comatose condition. Although raccoons are typically nocturnal animals, many of these incidents occurred in broad daylight, and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources thinks the odd raccoon behavior is a side effect of canine distemper. If that diagnosis is correct, raccoons baring their teeth at Youngstown people and pets aren't threatening to eat their brains. They're experiencing facial muscle spasms as their nervous systems escape their conscious control. Distemper is not transmissible to humans, but it's still pretty scary. And that'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.